But then he didn't want the IV. So the doctor held his arm down, which again, is that ethically okay?
Right. Restraint versus not restraint.
Yeah. And so then I did the IV, got his labs, and labs turned back all fine.
She said about twice a year she'd pull that scrapbook out and just cry. Just read about it, cry, and let all those emotions that have been building up out. Can you imagine you're cutting in and all of a sudden...
No, it just slaps you in the face.
It just blows up and hits you in the face?
No. I definitely can't.
And so, yeah, that bought him an ostomy bag for a year. Hey, all, welcome to another edition of Nurse Stories Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. John McCray. I'm a nurse practitioner practicing out of the state of Idaho. And I am a nurse in heart and have been for many years. And one of the things I love to do is hear all the stories out there because nurses have the craziest stories. So before I introduce my next guest, I just want to give a shout out to our sponsors, which is Five Square Aesthetics. Five Square Aesthetics is the company that helps nurses get into the aesthetic industry by helping them form their own businesses. They'll give you the legal support, the medical director, the knowledge, education, and the most important thing is they have a community that will make you successful in your role. So thank you, Five Square Aesthetics, for sponsorship. And without further ado, let's introduce our guest. Hi, this is Kayla Nillis.
Yes.
And Kayla Nillis is here to tell us some stories. So before we get going, Kayla, tell us a little bit about yourself. How'd you get into nursing? Where you grew up? That kind of thing. And we'll start there.
Yeah. Well, I'm Kayla. I was born and raised in Idaho. So I've been a nurse in Idaho for about 8 years or so. Kind of started out in med-surg ortho and then switched from that to float pool since I went to a different hospital to figure out what kind of floor, what kind of nursing I like to do, and kind of settled in later at an observation short stay type of unit. Yeah, so we get a lot of, the floor has changed the types of patients that we get throughout the years. Like it used to be more ER patients and like appendectomies, getting your gallbladder out, like all that kind of stuff, and
so
chest pain.
So short stay meaning that the patients stay for like a night?
Yeah, like 48 hours or less. Yeah. Okay. Now it's surgeries, pretty much just surgeries.
Whereas before it was medical stuff?
Yeah, medical or surgeries, kind of a combo.
Gotcha. So you've been at it for 8 years. What was your first job when you got into nursing?
It was med-surg ortho for like 2.5 years.
I
kind of got burned out on that a little bit.
So let me ask you a question. How long did it take you to get burned out on your first job?
Probably a year and a half, I would say.
And then how long did it take you to leave that first job?
2.5.
Okay, so the reason I'm asking that, are you baccalaureate prepared? Did you get a bachelor's degree?
Bachelor's.
Studies show that a baccalaureate prepared nurse will be in his or her first job for 2.5 years and then move on average. Mm-hmm. And you are right there, right?
Yep.
2.5. And I see that all the time. I see nurses getting burned out after about a year and a half. And they're like, okay, I'm going to start looking. And then it takes them about another 6 months to be like, okay, I got to get out of this, out of this mess. So you're very normal. And so after that 2.5 years, then what was your next job?
It was float pool. So I floated to all the units.
Except for the short stay.
Yeah, it was float pool probably for 2.5 years. And then the rest of it, I've been in the short stay.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
When you were in float pool, what was your favorite type of unit to work?
It was the short stay. Yeah. So then I was like, yep. I also weirdly liked behavioral health. It was it wasn't a part of the hospital. It was a separate facility. And so I'd have to drive over there, and it was very, very different. You'd be in a nurse's station that's kind of like locked away from all the patients. And then you'd have to go out and find your patient because they were all just kind of walking around, you know, chatting with each other. And so they might be sleeping in their room with three other guys, and you have to go in and wake them up and give them their meds,
It was more like a community healthing unit versus, hey, you're in your room, stay in your room type of situation.
Exactly. Yeah, they would go and do groups and watch TV together and go into the cafeteria and eat their different meals, you know, that kind of thing.
So you want to hear a crazy story. This is not my story. And the nurse, I would have this nurse on to tell this story, but she's passed away. Mm-hmm. And so, but here's my favorite behavioral health mental health story that I heard. Mm-hmm. So this friend of mine, she worked a clinic just like that. And everybody had their own rooms, but they had this big communal area. She worked night shift, and it was her and a medical assistant or a CNA that worked the night shift. Well, there was not a lot to do at night, right? These mm-hmm. patients are stable. They're just sleeping. And so they would just, you know, they'd have to have two people there. But the rooms could, you could lock down the rooms if there was an issue. So they would go on like 2 hours. They would switch off back and forth where they would take naps. Mm-hmm. And so they would be sleeping, and then 2 hours they would switch. And when we go take a nap, and then 2 hours they would switch, and just kind of keeping the floor going, right?
Yeah.
Because you had to have two people there. Well, this is the funny thing. The doors lock behind them. And so she went into this room, and the door got closed, and she got locked in with this patient.
Oh, no.
And she can't get out. And she didn't have a way of communicating to the person who's taking a nap. Mm-hmm. And it's like midnight. Well, she didn't wake him up for the nap. And guess what? All night long, her CNA is sleeping, and she's stuck with this guy in this room. And there's nobody else on the unit. Luckily, everybody else slept. She was in there for 6 hours.
No.
And she's like banging on the wall, trying to get him to wake up. But he was, you know, off in another part of the building. And he finally woke up and was like frantic, and he came and let her out. And he's like, oh my gosh, before the next shift came on, because it would have been, I mean, she probably would have been fired for that, right?
Yeah.
Or he got fired for that. And so, but yeah, I mean,
oh my gosh.
You don't want to be stuck with a mental health patient in a room at midnight.
No.
For 6 hours. So,
do they, I wonder if they had like security guards walking around, because that's how this one was. It was,
no, this, they were always this is rounded. Decades ago. You know, she was telling me, she was obviously an older nurse, but this is probably like early 90s type of thing, you know, or they didn't have security and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, mental health back then was crazy.
Jeez. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my craziest mental health story is actually not even at that facility, because all the crazy stuff mainly happened like on the kids' side, surprisingly. But I was on, I think it was like a medical surgical type of unit, and I went into this lady's room, and she was like coming at me with her walker.
Whoa. How old was she?
She was like coming in. I don't know. She was probably like 60s or something like that, but she was a mental health patient. She was always like talking to God and thinking he was in the room with her and stuff like that. So I think she had some schizophrenia and stuff like that going on potentially. But we always had to be really careful with her because she had pulled nurses' hair. Like, she'd throw something on the ground, and then, like, she'd try to grab your ponytail or whatever. And so if she dropped something on the ground, I'd just be like, oh, well, I guess it's staying there.
Right.
Yeah. And then she'd always pull we had these boxes on the wall, and she would always push the emergency button because she liked to have people, like, you know, coming in to her room. And, yeah. And so she did that to me once, and I was like, sorry, guys, don't come over here. We're trying to get her to not do that anymore. She's fine. I'm fine. You know, trying to get
people can go nuts. Did she like sundown and stuff too?
I'm sure. Yeah. I never did night shift, but I'm sure she,
have you ever worked night shift in your career?
No, just my preceptorship when I was still in nursing school. I worked in like the cardiovascular ICU doing that, but.
Did you like nights?
No. No, I did a wall at 2 a.m. and then I just couldn't get out of it.
That shits are awful. I mean, they're very standardized. They're very structured. Like, you know what your night's going to be like. And usually around, you know, you go to lunch at like 1 a.m., 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And you just kind of like laze around the unit while everybody's sleeping. And then, you know, 4 a.m. you start, you know, doing your morning rounds and getting people moving and whatnot. But it took a toll on my health. I mean, to this day, my sleep's messed up from it.
Oh, yeah.
I did 5 years of that crap.
It messes with you.
100%. It's now classified as a carcinogen to do long-term sleep work.
Yeah.
No.
It messes with you.
Thank you. Okay, well, that's a good story about mental health. What other kind of crazy stories you got?
So when I was in float pool, they were starting to train me to the ER, which, you know, I later determined I didn't want to do ER after this. But so I think my first shift on my own, I came into my shift, and then they gave me my first patient who had just gotten there. I think someone drove him there. He didn't speak English. So, you know, I got the the machine out, the interpreter machine. I think it was Swahili or something like that. So I was trying to ask him, you know, what's going on? What's wrong? What brings you in? And he just kept saying the same thing again and again and again. And it was like, I'm being bullied at Walmart, or I was bullied at Walmart or something like that. So we're thinking, okay, did he get hit in the head? Did he get beat up? Like, what? I wonder what's going on, you know? And so the doctor came in and same thing. He just like kept saying the same thing and over and over.
You're using a translator machine.
Yeah.
Okay. So you don't have that personal touch.
No. Okay. Yeah. So then the doctor wanted me to get labs. He's like, well, we don't know why this guy's here. Let's get labs. Just see if something's wrong. So, but then he didn't want the IV. So the doctor held his arm down, which again, is that ethically okay?
Right. Restraint versus not restraint.
Yeah. And so then I did the IV, got his labs, and labs turned back all fine. And he ended up ripping out his IV, his own IV, and he was just sitting on the ground. You know, so to this day, no idea why he's here.
No idea why he was there.
No. And then the doctor ended up being like, you know, if you're not here for any reason, and they put him in a taxi and sent him away. And I was like, this seems like really ethically weird to me. So I don't know. I just didn't like ER one way for that. And
well, you know, with the language barrier, people don't realize that hospitals are required to get you an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use these machines. Like, I didn't have the machines when I started nursing. We had a hotline where you had a call, and then this company would find some random person to help you with the language. And, you know, it was an ordeal. It was expensive. Like, the hospitals were paying like $100 an hour for, you know, somebody to translate for you. And every time you go in the room, you have to call this flipping number. Mm-hmm. And then the machines came out at the very end of my bedside nursing career, and we started playing with those, and those were a lot better. And my hunch is they're going to have some sort of AI thing where you just get on Google Translate and you're like, okay, tell me what's going on, and just talks back and forth.
Yeah.
Right.
If it's like a quick question, I'll do that with Google Translate.
So your Swahili reminded me of a story. Can I tell you my story? And this has nothing to do with nursing. When I was in my undergrad, I was getting my first degree was in biology. And we had a microbiology class.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, it wasn't microbiology. It was a general biology course. And at the lab, we would go through like invertebrates to vertebrates and dissect animals and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Well, in the invertebrate section, we talked, you know, it was about parasites and stuff like that. And so the professor said, hey, I want everybody to bring in a stool sample, and we'll see if you have any, what kind of parasites we have in there.
Mm-hmm.
We had this foreign exchange student, and he was from somewhere in Africa. I can't remember where. Spoke very little English. He brought in a stool sample, and it was just swimming with parasites because they don't have sanitation. They eat rotten food. I mean, it was just his culture. And I remember my professor was so excited, and they literally discovered a new species in this kid's school.
What?
They did. Yeah, they wrote a paper on it.
That's crazy.
Because this guy had all these parasites, and they're like, oh, you might want to go get treated. You know, probably got some ivermectin or something like that. But yeah, we have no idea what's out there. And so, you know, you play around in the dirt and you eat food that's a few days old, you're going to get something.
Yeah.
Wow. Back on the parasites, and I'm totally going off topic here. I read a story once that 1/3 of American children have a parasitic pinworm.
Hmm.
A pinworm is a little tiny worm that lives in your gut. Children, it's very common in children. They play in the dirt, you know, they get it. And a pinworm reproduces. It will, at night, it will crawl out of your anus, and it will lay little eggs around your anus while you're sleeping, and then it crawls back in. And those
terrifying.
Those eggs secrete an enzyme that makes you itch. Mm-hmm. So if you ever see a little kid like scratching their butthole, well, that's the whole point. And then they scratch, and then they play with their other friends and infect them, and that's this life cycle. And so if you ever suspect pinworm, what you're supposed to do is we tell parents in primary care, hey, we think we might have a pinworm. Go in the middle of the night with a piece of tape.
Mm-hmm.
Spread your kid's cheeks open, put a piece of tape down. You might catch a pinworm, but you'll definitely catch the eggs. And don't have any lights on, because as soon as the light hits, the little worm goes back inside. And so pinworms are really common. Weird. That nasty.
Yeah.
I've and we did have that. I do remember a patient in my in the hospital. He was an adult male. He was doing some sort of bowel surgery, and they found a whole bunch of pinworms in him. We had to put him in isolation, all that kind of stuff. But usually by the time you're an adult, you know, it's out of your system.
Yeah.
So
that's wild.
Parasites are wild. Yeah. Especially with, you know, luckily we eat like cooked food and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If we didn't, we'd be swimming with them. I mean, you go look like a bear. Bears are, their guts are just full of nasty stuff because they're eating rotten meat and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Pretty nasty. Okay. So that got you out of the ER.
Well, no, that wasn't it.
Oh, well, yeah. What else was it?
That was just the beginning that of the was day. The
beginning of the hell.
The one day. My first day. So, yeah.
That was your first day.
Yeah. No, and he was just the first patient that okay. I got. And then the second one, I was trying to... you know, figure out why this guy was here. But then I got another guy next to him and he was more critical. He jumped off of a boat, the back of a boat, and his calf got stuck in the boat propeller. Yeah. So I got to go take a pair of that really guy.
Like the Swahili guy.
Well, this guy, you know.
Well, this guy's legs almost chopped off.
Yeah. He ended up having to, I don't know, go to a bigger hospital, like Eli flooded over there for skin grafts and things like that.
Dang.
Yeah.
Probably in Utah. Utah mm-hmm. does a lot of the skin
grafts. Yeah, Salt Lake, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was that. And there was another one.
This is all the same night?
I think this other one was the next day.
The next day?
Yeah. I had my own pod, is what they call it. You know, you have your own little group of rooms. And I had, you know, like this really sick sepsis guy with really bad kidney failure. And then I, like some other patients. And then I got this other guy that was there for angioedema. His face was getting all swollen. So they sent him to CT to kind of see what was going on. And we gave him Benadryl and stuff like that. But there was another nurse that came and she was like, hey, I'm here to help you in your pod. And I was like, okay, do you want to take this guy that I just got? He's in CT, you know. And then he comes back and he can't breathe. He's saying he can't breathe. So then they had to trach him at the bedside.
Wow.
I know. And I was like, I'm kind of glad I didn't have him because I wasn't a critically care trained nurse. So I was like, good thing you had it. Getting the intubation tray and all that stuff. And I was like, oh my God.
Did they figure out what causes angioedema?
I think it was some kind of like allergic reaction or something.
Everything spilled up on him.
Yeah, just real fast.
Some epinephrine.
Yeah. Mm. That's crazy.
Yeah, people don't realize like when you're a nurse, you can go from calm, cool, collected to batshit crazy mm-hmm. in a second.
Absolutely.
And it will, you'll have the best night of your life and it'll go to the worst night of your life for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like just some crazy thing like, hey, this guy went to CT and now he's back and can't breathe. Let's strike him. Well, yeah. That's an hour,
mm-hmm.
right? You're dealing with that an hour. You got these other patients over here that
yeah.
you're not paying attention to because you're dealing with this guy and know that's, mm-hmm. it gets so nutty.
Yeah, and if you have multiple patients that are having issues, like I had that recently-ish, but I was by myself on the unit because you just have to have two people. It doesn't have to be two nurses. So it was just me and a CNA. And one of them, of course, if something bad's going to happen, it's going to happen at shift change, right?
Of course.
When I'm trying to leave.
Yeah, it always does.
And so... this, I think it was her evening vitals. It was a little lower than before, but nothing crazy. And I was like, let's keep an eye on it. Let me know if you're dizzy or anything like that, if your symptoms get worse. And so she did let me know at 7:15.
Of course.
And turns out, like, so her blood pressure was in the 70s.
Is she septic or something?
No, she had an internal bleed.
Whoa, was this post-surgical patient?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I was like... a hernia repair or something like that. But yeah, she was bleeding internally and it was like going pretty quick because at 5:30 or so when I got her vitals, there was 98 systolic. And then at 7:15, oh, it's 70 systolic. Called a rapid response, of course. And then it was 50s over 30s.
Ouchie.
Yeah, so she was blood struggling.
Blood.
Mm-hmm. She had a liter and a half of blood in her stomach.
Oof. Yeah, when you have, how many liters do you have? 8, 9 liters total?
Something like something that. Like, yeah.
You know, 1/8 of the blood or 1/7 of your blood is
mm-hmm.
not doing what it's supposed to, yeah. You ain't doing so good.
Yeah, and we had, and then I think the next day I had to give two people blood, and I was by myself also.
Oh, that's ridiculous. And for those of you who aren't nurses, with blood products, you have to get other people involved, right? So you have to track somebody else down to sign off to make sure you're giving the right blood to the right person. Because if you don't, they're dead, mm-hmm. right?
You have to verify.
Yeah, super bad. So you have to like verify five or six different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're by yourself, it's like, oh, I got to find somebody. Who can I find? So you got to mm-hmm. call somebody to come down, and the blood needs to go, and you only have a certain amount of time to get it into the patient, you know, yep. et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Two patients? They gave you two patients that are both getting blood?
Yeah. That's well, it just so happened that they needed blood. You know, one of them was more stable than the other. They were, you know, their levels were just low normal, but the other one was pretty low.
Yeah, they, at least when I was bedside nursing, they really lowered the requirement for when patients got blood. Apparently, 30, 40 years ago, they gave blood to everybody. If you were anemic, you got blood.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's got to be like severely anemic.
Yeah, your levels have to be like seven or lower. Yeah. Yeah,
that's what I remember. You know, they used to do it around 10.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's a seven. Probably a good thing. You know, mm-hmm. there's a shortage of blood. And
maybe the requirements are higher. Like there's more restrictions on who can and can't give blood. Mm-hmm. So it's harder to get a shortage.
My wife used to donate blood, and she would go down and donate, you know, once every quarter or so. And then one time she got a false positive that she had HIV. And so they did it. They're like, ooh, the test came back that you might have HIV. And she's like, how am I going to get HIV? And then they tested her again. They're like, no, you don't have it. She's like, oh, okay. And they're like, and by the way, you can never donate blood again. And she's like, why? She goes, well, because of this one false exam, it makes your blood worthless, even though it was a testing error.
What?
So she can't test. She can't ever do a blood donation again.
That's so weird, because mm-hmm. it wasn't even true.
Right. Huh. And then there's other blood products that are super timely, right? Like mm-hmm. they're only good for a day or two. And so with those, they don't even have time to test the patients. And I can't remember which blood product it is, but what they'll do is they'll find patients that are as low risk as possible of transmitting diseases to you. So like this one gentleman I know, he donates blood. He's a nurse. He would donate blood like once every 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And they put him on the short list for, hey, we need emergency blood. And so they'll call him and say, hey, can you come down? And he'll come down and they won't even test his blood. And it'll go straight from him to a patient, oh, you know, wow. for those emergency situations. But he's married, stable, not an IV drug user. You know, he's got 30-year track record of having good blood. Relatively safe, but it's, you know, on the patient side, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm getting blood that hasn't been tested.
Yeah.
Nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Right.
But sometimes the situation is that or you die.
I think it was like, I think it was like O negative or something. So that's why they always needed him or, mm-hmm. you know, or AB positive. I can't remember what blood type he was. The one that's really hard. It's probably not O neg, or maybe it is O neg, because you can give O neg to anybody, right?
Right.
Universal mm-hmm. donor. So that's a good one that people want to do, but.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, don't miss the days of doing blood. No. You have to get every last drop of that in them.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you definitely try to.
Yeah.
And it's only good for 4 hours, and then so you got to make sure you infuse it.
You got to make sure it's infused. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't miss those days. Yeah. Okay, well that was your ER experience. Mm-hmm. What about some unit experience, like bedside experience? You got anything fun? That any fun stories, crazy stories, people going nuts on you? Doctors yelling at you.
Oh yeah, I do have a crazy story. So I was on this unit. I was alone.
Unit being the surgical,
the observation unit. You know. So my patient, right when I got there, went into her room and she was kind of like doing this kind of thing, and like she had to go to the bathroom. So I took her to the bathroom and she like couldn't find the toilet paper roll. And I was like, something's weird, because the night shift nurse was still there. And she's like, oh, well, she wasn't really acting like this before. So I ended up doing like a stroke assessment on her just to see. And she was significantly weaker on one side, which is usually a sign of stroke. So called the doctor to come assess her, and he said, oh, well, let's kind of monitor her for a little while. And I was like, what? Because with strokes, you know, it's
minutes.
Yeah, right? you gotta be quick. And so that if you can give them like a product, TPA, to, you know, break up that blood clot or whatever it is, then you can do that. So I didn't really agree with that. So I called an MRT too and had them come look at her, which then they said, oh, well, let's get a stat CT, stat MRI, you know, whatever else. And she had a huge stroke on one side of her brain.
Wow.
Huge. And then the stroke coordinator came up to me, I think like a few hours later, and she said, if you wouldn't have caught this, like, she would have died. And so I thought that was so crazy.
Wow, saved a life.
Yeah. And I was like, because I didn't believe what they were telling me. So sometimes you have to
Trust your gut.
Trust your gut.
Trust your gut. If you don't, you're screwed and the patient's screwed.
Yeah. And sometimes you got to use the chain of command and stuff like that.
I've said this many times on this podcast, but patients don't go to hospitals for doctor care. They go to hospitals for nursing care. Otherwise, they'd be at home and they could just call their doctor, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you feel like something's wrong and the doctor disagree with it, go against them. It's okay. It's okay to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me, but stroke. So that reminds me of a stroke story I had, but it was when I was going through my NP rounds and I was in cardiology and doing a cardiology round. And we had this patient come in and she was there for heart and she had had an MI or something in the past. And so the nurse practitioner I was shadowing, she's talking to her and we're kind of looking at her and we're like, something going on here. Mm-hmm. She had like half her face was a little slouchy and she was weak on one side and she's not there for neurology. And we're like, hey, what's going on? She's like, oh, I've been like this forever. And we're like, something's not right. Like, I mean, this looks like stroke-like symptoms. So good for my preceptor. She's like, yeah, this doesn't feel right. Like, we gotta get you. And so even though it wasn't her problem, she ordered a CT scan.
Good.
And got her in to go CT scan. Giant tumor in her brain. And I remember seeing the CT scan, you know, a week later. When I say giant, like the size of your fist.
Oh my gosh.
And it had pushed her brain, you know, the midline of the brain. It had pushed the midline of the brain way to one side. And all that pressure from that tumor was just, you know, causing her right or left side. I can't remember which one.
Wow.
Right. And so my provider was like, that I was shadowing, she was like, no, something's wrong. Like, I know something's wrong. And then she had a huge surgery and I actually took care of her because I was still a nurse at the time. I actually took care of her. I floated to the neurology unit where she came and I actually took care of her after her surgery. And just by removing that thing, she got all of her.
Wow.
She was, her neural checks were pretty good.
Yeah, but tumors are pretty, like, it can be slow growing.
Well, it was, and that's what we knew it wasn't an acute stroke because she's like, oh, I've been like this for, I don't remember how long, months, years.
Oh, okay.
Something like that. She's like, I've always been like that. And I'm like, yeah, but I mean, it was just like so apparent. Like, she's got this like right-sided limp and she's using a cane on the other side and her right side didn't work well. And
so you're like, wait, why are you always like this?
Like, is your primary care provider not notice this?
Yeah. Have you ever been scanned or anything? Oh my gosh.
So yeah, that's wild. Crazy.
But with that patient, after they had their surgery, did they have like the helmet thing on or do you know?
They did. Yeah, they had the helmet thing on. I mean, took a chunk of their skull out. They evacuated. I don't know how much tumor, but she looked way better. I don't know how she did. That was the last time I saw her. So, okay. What other kind of good stories do you have? Do you have any touching stories or any?
Oh, yeah. Stories? I have a sad story.
Okay, let's
hear it. You want to hear a sad one?
I like to hear one and then we'll go to a funny one.
Yeah, yeah. So, this short stay type of unit that I worked on, it's kind of morphed, you know, what we've done the longer I've been there. So, it used to be that we'd get a lot of cancer patients that need infusions like weekly or every other day or something like that, or they need blood or very frequently. So I had these two patients and they both had cancer and one of them needed magnesium and fluids like every other day.
Jeez.
Yeah. And then the other one needed platelets like twice a week. So I really got to know them throughout all that time. And one of them, kind of an older gentleman, he was in his, I don't know, 50s, late 50s or 60s. And he had a daughter and she got in a car accident and passed away. Yeah. And then I remember seeing him a little while after that, and he just looked very defeated and everything, kind of looked like he kind of lost hope, which was super sad to see. But then he ended up passing away like shortly after his daughter did. I think it was like a month or two later.
He gave up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other cancer patient that I had, he passed away like within a week of that guy.
Were they kind of friends on the unit?
Mm-mm. No, they didn't know each other, but it was just happenstance. This other guy.
And your unit's not known for deaths. So that must have been hard.
No, they didn't pass on my unit. It was more like they would just come for an infusion and then go home.
And then one day they don't show up.
Yeah. And then so I was like, what the heck? Why aren't they here? And then I found out that they had both passed away that previous week.
That's hard.
Mm-hmm. And the other gentleman, he was in his 20s.
Oh.
Mid-20s.
Ouchie.
Yeah.
That's sad.
And he told me this crazy story. Like, he had this giant basketball-sized tumor in his stomach where he then had to be in the ICU for a long time when they removed it because then they couldn't close his abdomen. So he just had an open abdomen in ICU.
It open. They didn't put, like, a wound back or anything on it?
I think they might have.
Sure they did.
Yeah. I don't think you could just leave it open.
They usually wouldn't do that.
Yeah, but then he used to be like this big guy. He said, I used to be like almost 300 pounds, big, huge, like beard. And then when I saw him, you know, of course he was bald and thin and all that.
So they didn't get all the cancer metastasized and mm-hmm. took him out.
Yeah, he was really sick. Yeah.
That's hard. That's hard. I did my, when I was in nursing school, I did my student rotation through oncology. And I really liked it, but I didn't understand the emotional toll it would take on you. And so I had a really good preceptor. She taught me everything I know. And literally the last day of my rotation, we had this patient we were dealing with. I don't recall her name, but she was young, 22, breast cancer or something like that, and was in the hospital for all the chemo and whatnot. And you get to know her. I mean, I was there for a whole semester. And show up, and she's not doing well. And my preceptor, we went and did our assessment. We come out. This is 7 in the morning. She goes, she's going to be dead by the end of the day. And I'm like, how do you know? And so then I asked her, I go, how do you deal with death? And she said her process was, because everybody on her unit died. I mean, very rarely did somebody, you know, live.
That's hard.
Well, I don't know what the statistics are, but a lot of people on her unit died. And they're long-term patients, so you get to know them. And you get to know their families and all this stuff. And she said what she would do is all these people that she would touch their lives with, she would go home and make a scrapbook and like take, because they had photos and stuff, and she'd take a photo and she'd put it in her scrapbook, and then she'd write a few notes and then put it away. And she said about twice a year she'd pull that scrapbook out and just cry. Just read about it, cry, and let all those emotions that were building up out. Mm-hmm. That was her process. So anyways, back to the story. It's my last day. Like, I'm done with my student preceptorship. I'm a month away from graduation. I'm going to go get a job. And she makes this declarative statement. She'll be dead by the end of the day. Well, it's 7 p.m. And she was still alive and kicking. And I cannot tell you, like, how often this happens. But it's 7:23, 7 minutes before the shift end, this young lady passed away. And it was horrid because the family knew she was going, and they would stay there and they were waiting, and then they all went to dinner, and that's when she passed. Oh. And so when they came back to the floor and she had passed, it was wailing and throwing themselves on the floor, and they're like, why didn't you wait for us? Like, what, you know? Well, she obviously passed because there was nobody there. And yeah. Super sad. And I stayed an extra like 45 minutes after the shift, like learning at the death process. Because that was my first patient I ever encountered that had actually died on my unit. And then finally my preceptor's like, she could tell it was really bothering me. And she's like, you need to go home. Like, let's not leave your preceptorship on a sour note. But from that, I was like, I can't be in a situation where I'm dealing with death every day. Like, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's hard.
And so, because I was trying to get a job on that unit, and I'm like, no, I'm gonna switch. I'm gonna do something. And so, you love people, But the longer they stay, the more they start to bother you.
Right.
You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, unless they're, I mean, they'd have to be like an angel for you to be like, oh, I'm so glad you're here. Because even when you like them, you're like, gosh, I don't want them here anymore. I want them to get better. I want them to get out. Even those people you like. And the long-termers are just so much work and so emotional. It's the emotional work that just really gets to you. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, especially when you get to know them, it makes it harder, especially when they, you know, have cancer so then they eventually pass and it just really plays a toll on you because 100%. You just know them so much more.
Gotcha.
It's very hard.
Well, let's shift gears. Let's do something funny.
Yeah.
So I have a segment I do with every nurse, and sometimes nurses have this and sometimes they don't. Do you have any stories of someone getting something stuck somewhere it shouldn't have been? Like an up the butt story or an impalement or, you know, swallowed something funny or anything like that?
There was this one patient I had where he got a giant dildo stuck up there, you know?
It's always a guy.
He probably fell on it, you know?
You're right. It's always a guy. They always fall on it, mm-hmm. right?
And he ended up needing an open surgery to get it removed.
Yeah, for those of you who aren't in the medical field, most surgeries are tried to do laparoscopic, which you just make little incisions and they put like tubes and stuff and they do all the surgeries just through little tiny holes. So when you have an open one, it's pretty serious, right? Because that's the old way of doing it. They just slice a big thing, open you up and go in and dig it out.
Mm-hmm.
So you got it stuck up there, huh?
Yeah, supposedly.
Did you take care of him? Was he like what was his story? Like, did he like try to make an excuse?
So I think that we were gonna get him and he ended up coming after my shift, but like since I was a charge nurse, I had to like look things up about him, you know, because he was gonna come to us, and so I was like, oh.
I gotta tell my funniest story. We had this doctor and she was very crass, both to the nurses and to her patients. Not the best bedside manner. I mean, she was a dear, like she loved her patients and stuff, but she was very like authoritarian and, you know, alpha, and crass would be a good word. And so we had a patient come in. I was on the gastrointestinal unit, so it happened all the time. We had all these up the butt stories, but this patient came in and got stuck a if I remember right, like an 18 inch long dildo up there.
Wow.
Yeah, it was long. And so, couldn't get it out, has to have surgery, opened surgery. And so we see this and it's funny. It's tragic for the patients. I mean, they obviously don't want to go to the hospital, but it's really funny for nurses because like, ooh, what happened? And you read all the operative reports and all the work.
Right.
Because the doctors are very, you know, they'll go in and they'll write very good notes. So I'm reading her surgical report. And she's talking about making this incision and, you know, trying to find the object. Well, she opens them up and spreads them up and cuts open the bowel to get, you know, the object out. She writes in her note, the foreign body sprung forth out of the belly and slapped me in the forehead.
No.
Yeah. So it was under so much pressure that when she alleviated it, it sprung out like an alien. And smacked her in the forehead. And she literally wrote that in her notes. And we were all dying laughing because you're reading this and she, you know, this crass individual writes this and she's trying to be funny and professional at the same time. And it was both funny and professional at the same time that this dildo. I mean, can you imagine you're cutting in and all of a sudden.
No, it just slaps you in the face.
It just blows up and hits you in the face.
No. I definitely can.
And so, yeah, that bought him an ostomy bag for a year.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I bet you have a lot of, you know, what's in your butt kind of stories. Like,
I try to save them. I like to sparse them out over this. I got, I don't know, I got probably 20 of them, but I try to sparse them out over this. But that's probably one of my favorite ones just because I was really fond of this doctor and she was great. But she was a little on the sassy side.
Yeah.
For sure. So, okay, well, we're going along. How about one more story? You got one more story you'd like to share?
Yeah, let me see what my best.
Yeah, let's have one more story and then we'll call it a wraps and we'll kind of go from there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, smiling.
I got a good one.
We got a good one.
It was just very surprising. We'll just say.
Oh yeah, let's go for it.
So this was when I was a new nurse, of course. So my CNA had come up to me, and said, you know, I'm a little suspicious of our patient. She went into the bathroom with her purse and she was kind of acting weird to begin with, thinking that we were hot, that she was high or something. And so she said, can you just go see what she's doing? So I knock on the door and I hear rustling around and she says, just a minute. I was like, I'm just going to open the door. So I opened the door and she had like a whole like kit of drugs on the floor, which, you know, brand new nurse. I'm like, what do you say to that? I think I just said, what are you doing?
She said, hey, get me. I got a vein right here. Let's go.
She hadn't gotten that far yet. I caught her pretty quick.
Oh, that'd be a disaster.
Yeah. So she, I kind of kicked her stuff away, making sure, you know, the needles weren't, you know, near my foot or anything, but then I called security, I think, and they came up and it ended up being heroin.
Of course.
She had like a spoon and all this stuff like in her kit, and that was crazy.
Yeah, and she was probably on opiate situation. Pain, right?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. This is like a long time ago.
She probably would have overdosed or something.
Yeah.
So you nipped that one in the bud.
Yeah, not today. Not on my watch.
So how much heroin did they find?
I don't know how much it was, but it wasn't crazy.
Because, you know, they can't call the cops.
Oh, yeah.
They can't. I mean, this is protected health, right?
Well, what if they took the drugs and then called the cops and gave it to them?
Well, I don't know what they do.
I don't either.
That happened a couple times where we tossed the rooms and security took it. And I never found out, like, what happened to this stuff because they're not going to give it. It's patient's personal belongings. It's illegal, right? Do they give it back to them when they leave? Do they?
Wouldn't think so.
I don't know. I don't know. I know they don't call the cops. And they might call the cops like, hey, we have some illicit contraband here and that we're not going to tell you where it came from. Mm-hmm. You know, there might be something like that. But yeah, I mean, there was a couple times. Joints and little things. I've never found a bag of heroin.
Yeah.
But a lot of times they take their own medicines, like they're on opiates and stuff. They pop their own pills. That just messes you up.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're giving them pills on top of pills, and then you're like, what the hell's going on?
They're double dosing.
Oh, yeah.
It's dangerous.
Well, those are some great stories. So I hear recently you took on a new challenge in nursing.
Yes, I did.
Tell us what's going on.
Well, kind of starting to get a little bit worn out with hospital and politics, so started doing aesthetics, Botox.
Mm-hmm. A little bit on the side, huh?
Yeah, a little side money.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's good. Got all the education done and everything. Just need to learn my charting system and then good to go. Oh yeah,
so you're brand new at it.
Yeah, brand new.
And you went through Five Square Aesthetics, who's our sponsor. Thanks again, Five Square.
Mm-hmm.
And how was that process for you?
I thought it was good. You know, they make it easy for you. I don't have to, there's someone that helps with coordinating stuff, like getting your LLC done and setting you up at the charting system, what insurance company to go through, all this other stuff. So it's pretty easy to get started. Yeah.
Education's included, which is nice.
Which has been good.
They get you the lawyer to help you set up your business. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, good. Well, I can't wait till you start injecting people. And you're doing it with a friend, right?
I am. Yeah. We're trying to decide just staying mobile or going with renting a room or something like that to see.
Yeah, they both have advantages. The rooms are nice because you can set up your shop.
Mm-hmm.
But being mobile is very convenient for patients, and you can usually charge a little bit of a premium for that.
Mm-hmm.
Patients like, oh, I don't have to get up and leave my house. I can come in and you can do it. Both have their benefits. Both have their pluses.
Yeah. So the one perk to the renting a room is they said they would get you clients, which would be nice.
So with the room, are you looking at like a salon or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good way of doing it because you got all these, you know, you treat all the, you know, hairdressers and say, hey, just send me a few patients and you start a business, right?
Yeah, it's just hard to say because it's either they take a commission or they take, or they charge you rent. So it's hard to decide.
Pay the rent.
What's better?
Pay the rent.
The rent.
Oh, well, I can't wait till you actually get started and you see how much money you can make because you'll be like, oh my gosh, I worked how many hours at the hospital dealing with crazies and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I can make $1,000 in less than an hour, or, you know, let's call it 2 hours.
Yeah.
And you're like, dang, that's a lot of extra shifts at the hospital.
Yeah, right? It'd be nice to like kind of go part time, you know, and
yeah, I see a lot of female nurses get into it because then when they have babies and stuff, they could be moms and they could still do this part time and still make a little bit of money.
Right.
In a very short amount of time. So, well, cool. I can't wait to, we'll have you back after you're, 6 months into it.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Tell us your story with that and how successful you were and, some pitfalls to avoid and whatnot. So
for sure.
All right, Kayla. Well, thanks for joining the podcast today. I love hearing these stories. They're great. And if you're a nurse watching this and you want to come on, just reach out to us at Boise Podcasts. Nate@boisepodcast.com as the email address, and we'll get you booked. So thanks again for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
And it was a pleasure.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.